On August 11th, UBC political science professor Mike Wallace and Red Eye Collective member Mordecai Breenberg spoke at a forum on nuclear weapons and war. The event took place at the Vancouver Public Library and was organized by StopWar.ca. Their talks focused on the continued threat of nuclear weapons. We'll rebroadcast both talks, and Red Eye would like to especially thank Tom Childs and Global Justice TV for providing us with a recording of the forum for rebroadcast. We begin with Mike Wallace on failure of the anti-nuclear weapons negotiations and the dangers of war.
First of all, the issue of nuclear power, which is coming to the fore again. I go back a long way on this. During the 1970s, under Robert Bonner, and BC Hydro wanted to start nuclear power plants in British Columbia. And I was president of chapter president of an organization called Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. And by God, we stopped them. So I feel... To this day, I think of that as one of my great sense of fulfillment and completion in life, that we managed to keep those buggers out of here. But nuclear power isn't the issue, because that's a whole separate thing, and it really is kind of complicated. The other thing one mentions in terms of anniversaries is this is not only the 60th anniversary year of the dropping of the bomb. It's also a double anniversary for Albert Einstein. It is the 100th year since the publication of his two key papers that led to the revolution in nuclear physics that ultimately led to our understanding of how he used that in ways good or bad. And there are good ways, but unfortunately they've been overshadowed. Secondly, it's of course the 50th anniversary of his death. So it's a sort of double anniversary. And I always like to quote Einstein, because he, unlike many scientists, he was smart about everything. He was not just smart about physics, he was smart about politics too. And when the bomb went off and the news came in, which after all he was instrumental in getting the Manhattan Project started through his letter to President Roosevelt, he said, now everything has changed save our way of thinking, and thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. What he meant, of course, was that we intelligent apes can make technology that our hindbrains simply don't understand how to control, or whatever other part of our body it is. So we have this huge gap in development between our moral and political sense and systems and the technology that we can create. And that's going to come up in area after area as biotech goes forward, as other things go forward. You know, I'm sure it's just going to get worse. Anyway, let's go back to nuclear weapons and start with the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Now, in the 1960s, especially after the first Chinese nuclear explosion at Loch Nor in 1964, existing nuclear powers began to get worried that the nuclear club was going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. In the case of the Americans, they were particularly worried that a lot of countries they didn't like or potential adversaries were going to get nuclear weapons. In the case of Russia, it was quite specific. They were worried the Germans were going to get nuclear weapons. So for once, the Americans and Soviets made common cause, along with a lot of other anti-nuclear nations, such as Canada, and Canada was instrumental in this, by the way, to create something called the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Now, this meant that nations basically, it was presented to the public as saying this is going to stop there being any more nuclear nations, okay? Now, in fact, it wasn't that, because treaties are never diktats from one side to another unless they're treaties of surrender after a war. What it was actually a bargain. It was a bargain between the nuclear weapon states and the non-nuclear weapon states. The non-nuclear weapon states said, okay, we won't get nuclear weapons if, and this is in Article 6 of the treaty, read it yourself, it's very clear, if you start getting going on disarming your own nuclear weapons, okay? This part, Article 6, simply gets forgotten, and especially by the Western media, and more especially by American media, and totally, of course, by Fox News. The fact is, it is a bargain. Now, unfortunately, the nuclear weapon states, far from carrying out their end of the bargain, from 1970 through the end of the Cold War in 1990, increased their total number of strategic nuclear weapons by a factor of 50. In other words, multiply that by 50. Tactical nuclear weapon inventories also increased enormously, and in fact, we do not know the totals for either the United States or the Russian Federation. And in fact, unfortunately, the Russian Federation doesn't know either, which is the other problem. This bargain, this really always was a bargain. It was not a matter of a two-tier system or a caste system or something like that. To skip forward after, of course, the Cold War meant that basically nobody gave a damn about this except the main thing was to overcome the evil empire and all that sort of stuff. Skipping forward, however, to 1995, which was the first, it was doubly significant. First, the treaty was set to expire in 1995, and secondly, it was the first they would have. The treaty always called for review conferences every 5 years on the years beginning in zero, ending in 0 and 5. Okay. In 1970 on. Now, the 1995 review conference was doubly important because this was the time the treaty was due to expire, and secondly, it was the first time when everybody could really catch their breath and reassess the situation after the end of the Cold War. So one was going to hope that this would lead to the entire treaty, first of all, not only an extension of the treaty, but also some serious commitments on part of the nuclear weapon states to move towards getting rid of weapons that now had no conceivable purpose whatsoever. They were just sitting there. In fact, what happened was that the West particularly took over the conference, and there was a kind of unholy alliance between the peace movement and the mainstream Western powers, because they were very concerned about the fact that the treaty was about to expire. So what they wanted and got, and this includes the organization I'm a member of, Pugwash, was an indefinite extension of the treaty. The United States also put enormous economic pressure on a large number of countries, particularly Muslim and Arab countries, to sign the NPT. They had not done so before because Israel had not. But of course, needless to say, there was no pressure put on Israel. In fact, nobody even mentioned it, really. But Egypt signed, and a lot of other nations signed as well. This theme of Israel getting a pass on this is going to keep coming up again and again, because it's one of the major problems with the regime. This is what happened. A lot of nations were brought into the fold, and by the way, both Koreas in the same way. One could say three Koreas: North, South, and Chick. I suppose, I don't know. Anyway, hey, look, this stuff is so depressing. You've got to be funny. Okay, all right. There was no pressure on Israel, and of course, the 1995 renewal was rendered almost meaningless by the weaponization tests of India and Pakistan in 1998, and they had now weaponizable nuclear weapons. Pakistan was particularly important, and I'll get to the reason why in a minute. The 2000 review conference, people were now beginning to get into almost panic, and there was a formation of the Nuclear Abolition Coalition, or the NAC, as it's called, this was a group of countries ranging from New Zealand through Brazil and a whole bunch of others, who were determined to get Article 6 back on the table, the article that said that the big powers, the existing nuclear powers, had to disarm too. So it led to, for the first time, all five formally recognized nuclear weapons states under the NPT agreed to something, a list of steps to get rid of their nuclear weapons called so-called 13 points. Actually, there's 18, but it's always called 13 points. We won't get into that. Point is, for the first time, the United States actually put pen to paper saying we want to get rid, at some point, we want to get rid of our nuclear weapons. This is absolutely astounding. Okay, this was, of course, remember, Clinton was still in office at that point. Wasn't Bush yet. Now, what, of course, changed everything was 9/11. And in response to 9/11, the Americans changed their nuclear doctrine quite massively. They produced something called the 2001 Nuclear Posture View, which my old friend Bill Arkin leaked to the Los Angeles Times, and which is now available quite openly in most of the literature, even though it was classified. And basically that nuclear posture review called for, I won't get into all the details and I'm not going to use the military jargon for it because it's impenetrable, but basically the status quo regarding existing arsenals, there was a token agreement in Moscow in which the idea was to get down the number of warheads on active status, but in fact it didn't mean very much of anything because the countries had 10 years to do it, and the treaty expired in 10 years. So, you know, what does that mean? And then they didn't have to get rid of them. They didn't have to get to actually destroy the nuclear warheads. They just had to put them in storage. And not have them on weapons, which doesn't do very much. Secondly, the nuclear posture review expanded massively the grounds for nuclear first use. This is very clear. Any sort of threat or attack, and it not has to be an attack, but any even a threat to the United States that is deemed serious could result in the first use of nuclear weapons, and that would be decided by the United States alone, all by itself. Okay. In other words, forget multilateralism, forget treaties, forget everything. We're the 800-pound gorilla. We're going to do whatever the bleep we want. Okay, that's what that said. And then finally, the provision to develop a whole new generation of so-called usable tactical nuclear weapons. This is so Freudian. It's funny. Robust nuclear earth penetrator. Isn't that beautiful? Whoa, Papa Freud would love that one. Anyway, but the point is actually the physics of that doesn't work, and I'll get into that in the Q&A if you want to. It's impossible to do this without blowing a ton of stuff into the air. Scientists at MIT, real rocket scientists, who are not working for the government, have pointed out that the physics of this will not allow it to work without blowing a huge amount of fallout all over the place. So anyway, the point is the U.S. backed off on all its 2000 commitments and has said, in effect, we will decide when we will use our nuclear weapons, and we reserve the right to do that at any time, any place whatsoever. There's no limitation on that at all. And secondly, we will also decide who will and will not be allowed to have nuclear weapons. We alone, not the international community, not a treaty, nobody else. That's what it says. If you look at it and read between the lines and get the thing clear. So the result was that the United States proceeded in the next series of conferences on nuclear weapons to simply go ahead and wreck the joint. They sent, as their representative, the year before each of these quinquennial reviews, there's always a preparatory conference to set the agenda and everything. Well, the 2004 preparatory conference, they sent John Bolton. Well, you can figure out it was like a bull in a china shop. He just simply trashed the conference. I mean, that's all there is to say it. And following that, as a result, the 2005 review conference, it was really quite surrealistic, I guess is the word to be in that. Difficult place to, the UN is a very difficult place for NGOs to work in, among other things. The place where you meet reporters and you meet delegates, because the UN is its own jurisdiction and not part of New York State. It's the only major building in New York where you can still smoke, and that gets really, really irritating. But anyway, The point is that the 2005 conference was trashed by the two things. First of all, the United States, who refused to agree for nearly half the conference, for two of the 4 weeks of the conference, they refused to agree on the agenda. That doesn't get you anywhere, okay? And secondly, they spent almost all of their time in the conference sessions, plenary sessions, denouncing Iran. And very little time doing anything else. Now, the result was, of course, that gave, because their bad behavior was so outstanding, it allowed a lot of other nations to slip through to behave rather badly as well. So, nobody was really behaving very nicely there. A few exceptions. One was Canada's. Canada's closing statement to the conference is available on the Foreign Affairs website. You should read it. It is a masterpiece of good diplomacy and in the Pearsonian style, but unfortunately Canada has has less influence, quite literally, less influence in Washington now than Turkmenistan. Turkmenistan is important. It's got air base in it. So anyway, we have probably less influence than that. So the result is the non-proliferation treaty, for all practical purposes, is really dead. And this is very serious because it is important to have this regime in place. It is important to control the spread of nuclear weapons, and it is also important to take Article 6 seriously and draw down these arsenals before they get themselves loose, and they're going to. There's still over 2,000 on each side on hair trigger, meaning they can be fired within 3 minutes. And this is insane. I mean, how many years now after the Cold War? 15 years, basically, after the Cold War, and they're still pointing, almost 5,000 of these things at each other, ready to go in 3 minutes. What is the point of that? Inconceivably. But anyway, the other reason why the NPT regime is critical is because proliferation has become easier. And the reason is because, and I said I'd get back to Pakistan, I'm going to. Pakistan could not follow the usual route in building nuclear weapons. It didn't have the technology. But what they were able to do is to figure out how to enrich uranium using conventional materials in centrifuges rather than exotic materials. That means you could use commercial grade aluminum alloys, fancy ones, mind. And fancy commercial grade steels in the centrifuges instead of the exotic materials that were used by the great powers, and that meant that the whole business was much easier. And so enriching uranium-235 just became a huge amount easier, and that technology spread around the globe very quickly thanks to Dr. E.Q. Khan. And a few others like him. So the result is even Malaysia has talked about getting a bomb now. And it's not outside their capabilities, quite frankly. It's easy to do, and the thing about uranium-235, as Pugwash pointed out, way back in 1995, we were saying, watch the enriched, highly enriched uranium, because it's very, very easy to design a bomb out of highly enriched uranium. It won't have quite the bang the plutonium one does, but the difference in kilotons is not going to make a lot of difference if you drop one in the middle of a city, and it's just a question of whether you destroy two-thirds of the city or the entire thing. I mean, really, it's not hell of a lot of difference. Anyway, so where we're at with that is that the proliferation could spread, but it has become so highly politicized and so confrontational that I don't see much progress at the moment. The DPRK, North Korea, probably does have nuclear weapons, but the U.S. really has nothing they can do about it. They've sort of handed that file over to China, but China doesn't want to. China has good economic relations with North Korea, and of course, a war in Asia, especially a war with North Korea, would result, even assuming nukes were not used, because so much ordnance is trained on Seoul, which is just immediately south of the border, the casualties in the first few days would be in the six figures. And if nukes were to play, they would be in the seven figures. Okay, so really, a war in that region is not conceivable. There is no preemptive strategy that makes any sense for the United States, and besides which, China might get quite irritable about it, as they did the last time, if you will remember how the Korean War got started. So they're basically just going to have to sit there and talk about it, that basically there is another nuclear power in the world, and quite frankly, if I had to rate on a sanity scale, yes, I know the Marx Brothers says there is no sanity clause, but if there were a sanity clause in, then I'm afraid at the bottom of the list would be the leadership of the DPRK. They really are several bricks short of a load. I mean, they really are, and that's the problem. And Iran is not, because they have quite rational leadership. You may not agree with their goals, but they're perfectly rational. They have a very effective foreign policy, a very effective diplomacy. I remember the second oldest diplomatic tradition in the world after the Chinese, if we remember. And a very effective secret police, by the way. But anyway, the point is, it's the focus of American anger, because they can't do anything about North Korea, and they know it. Also because the Israeli lobby is after them about this. And somehow it has come to be the case that the possibility of one Iranian bomb is somehow massively more serious than the known existence of 200 Israeli bombs. Now, as far as I know, they could well be argued that the Iranian leadership might be is certainly a dictatorship. One could make that argument, but unlike the Israeli government, it is not led by a war criminal. And in fact, the existing nuclear powers are almost all, their leaders are either almost all war criminals or dictators or both, virtually to a man. So the spin is the Iranians are the devils with horns, and everybody else is pristine. The only commentary that would even, and of course, the United States media has now got to the point where the only decent show that actually has political commentary on it is on the Comedy Network. The major news shows, the major networks, of course, are just so scared of breaking with the consensus and so on, and being considered traitors. It's like, it reminds me very much of, I'm old enough to remember the tail end of the McCarthy era, and very much like that, I think. Now, actually, let me give you the facts about Iran, okay? Not the crap you're getting from whatever media you're getting on. First of all, Iran is not violating the NPT. Get this. It is not violating the NPT. Because under the NPT, there is nothing to prevent it from enriching uranium. What all of the NPT says is you can't make a bomb. It doesn't say you can't enrich uranium. Now, the trouble is, the one with the new technology, the one aligns to the other. I understand that, but guess what, guys? If the United States to barefaced sit there with 5,000 strategic nuclear warheads and say that that the world is presented with enormous danger by the possibility of Iran having one, it's just a bit thick. To be honest with you, just a bit much. Secondly, again, no mention of Israel. It just simply is off the map. You cannot mention Israeli nuclear weapons. Part of this, by the way, is the fact that there is a very broad consensus in Israel itself that nuclear weapons are okay among both major political blocs. Interestingly enough, by the way, we talk about my membership in Pugwash. One of the things that Sir Joseph Rotblat, who is the President Emeritus and the Nobel Laureate, not me, in this in this bunch, always makes a point, every single annual Pugwash meeting invites Mordecai Vanunu to come to the Pugwash meetings. Of course he can't, but the gesture is made every year and has been made every year for a number of years now. I can't remember how long. And he is very powerfully, of course, one of the things Pugwash tries to do and has publicized is the plight of Mordecai Vanunu, the whistleblower on Israeli nukes, and try to do something about it.
That was Mike Wallace speaking at the Vancouver Public Library on August 11th.